Hello and welcome. I am John Cryer, and this is the Undisclosed Addendum. In the most recent episode of The State vs. Willie Vesey, we explored the state's star witness recantation of her testimony and whether it will or will not have an effect on the case. And with me today is one of the hosts of Undisclosed. She's also a blogger at The View from LL2 and the host of the 45th podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Susan Simpson.
Hey,
this is the first time. This is the first time I've simulated a studio audience. I'm going to be doing this all through the podcast this week. I hope that doesn't throw you off. Also with us are Jim Fagorski and Marissa Bluestein. Jim was a Philadelphia police officer for 25 years, from 1981 until 2006, retiring as a lieutenant. After he got his law degree in 2009, Jim volunteered to assist the Pennsylvania Innocence Project to evaluate cases for merit, and has since worked with both Sean Thomas and Willie Vesey. Marissa Bluestein has been with the Pennsylvania Innocence Project since its inception in April 2009. Beginning as the project's legal director, Marissa was made executive director in 2017. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Thank you.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us.
So glad. Now, you guys, we got to start with the new evidence. That's obviously very exciting. But what does it mean, and why would it be put under seal?
It's under seal because the DA's office objected, basically, because... Yeah, Marissa Bluestein actually found the evidence, and she provided it to the people who were representing Willie Vesey and one other person, and they're basically what we consider to be Brady violations that we can't discuss. And the DA's office objected to finding these the way that we did, which is the result of a federal civil suit, and they don't believe that these should be used in state court, and they're trying to prevent us from doing so by filing it under seal and calling them confidential. So we're waiting for the judge's ruling on whether these items are in fact confidential, and we can't discuss them until that happens.
Can you explain their logic there a bit more? I don't even understand how they even formulated that argument, that because it's a federal case where it was discovered, it's somehow inadmissible in state court?
Yeah, they're claiming...
Yeah, that's the essence of it.
But why?
You know, honestly, it comes down to a matter of procedure, that the position from the Commonwealth is that these items would not be discoverable in state court, and that by getting them through the use of a federal civil suit, we have kind of skirted state procedure, so that therefore the state courts should follow their own procedure and either grant an independent motion for discovery or deny it based upon the merits in front of the state judge. But that we as litigants should not be allowed to bring information that we have obtained through another means into court.
But what does it matter where you, like, if you like found it on the street, could you not use it?
Apparently not. I mean, I think that the Commonwealth believes that somehow Jim and I manufactured a case and forced the Commonwealth to produce discovery in order to use that in other claims involving other individuals. Would that I were that Machiavellian, but it's just that we have been involved in a lot of these cases surrounding the one that's active in federal court for years. And we have been consulting with the attorneys on that case for years since they filed it, because we know a lot about these officers and the allegations. So they contacted us so that they could understand the cases themselves, because we know them very well. And in the course of reviewing that information, you know, if I find information in reviewing a case that I have a legitimate reason to review, and it's clear to me that that information has never been turned over and could potentially exculpate someone, and at the very least is a constitutional violation, of course I have an obligation to my client and the Constitution itself to take action on that, which is exactly, of course, what we did. So, essentially the Commonwealth's position boils down to that this information... Yeah, we provided it in discovery. Yes, we did not protect it through a confidentiality order. And frankly, it's only confidential to the one person for whom it can be a benefit, which is the person who's named in the file.
Okay, but I still don't understand why. So if the state is claiming that this should have been pursued through state channels, am I understanding that correctly?
That's their position.
Then you can't get them in state channels.
Well, we can. Correct. I mean, there's discretion in state channels. It's not forbidden by any means. We have a right to know law for Pennsylvania, which is akin to the Federal Freedom of Information Act. And the right to know law does not prohibit the Commonwealth or the police department from giving over evidence. It just allows them not to. So the Commonwealth's position that we cannot get it in state court is just untrue. It's not the law. But the fact is we have it and we want to use it because it benefits our client and you know, exposes a great injustice and very serious constitutional violations, not just for our client, but for others.
So it sounds like a delaying tactic, because unless there is some, I'm just trying to think of, is there a rationalization? Are they worried that for some reason, because it came from federal discovery, that somehow damages the process for the state?
I think they probably know there's a lot of other cases like this, and they're worried about where else it can be used. But that's pretty cynical.
Put it this way, when called to it, I think out of four filings from the attorneys saying, they have no legal basis for saying that the discovery should not be provided. The Commonwealth could not provide a single case or citation to any authority which said that the documents cannot be provided to us.
Right, that's correct. And I still maintain that they have no legal basis for saying so. And I'm hoping that that's what the judge is going to rule, but we can't do anything until she does make the ruling. It's been about 2 months now, so
right.
Hopefully it'll be soon.
One other semi-related question in ruling news. I talked with Colin a little bit last week about the Supreme Court of Georgia's ruling on the Joey Watkins case, but I haven't talked to you, Susan. Do you have any particular feelings about that?
Yeah, I have lots of feelings about that. It's devastating. It's not surprising necessarily because it's terrible. I mean, I'm very glad I did not accidentally cause the state of Georgia to rule no one can get copies of court records. So, you know.
So that's the upside.
Our attorneys in that case did an amazing job. They did phenomenal briefs and the arguments were fantastic. If you listen to the episode, you would have heard how it went. And I would say it was not remotely an even match between us and the Floyd County attorneys. And I'm disappointed for myself and for Joey, but also for them because they really believed in this case and the cause and put a lot of work into it. And Joey's devastated too. He takes it as a sign that I had to talk to him. I'm like, look, there's nothing to do with your case. They're not ruling on your case. Like, this is not an indication of how, when eventually your case goes before the Supreme Court of Georgia, they're going to rule there. And to be honest, I would love to have it for Joey's sake. I think there's a lot of powerful audio in there that the world needs to hear. But this doesn't really impact him so much as the other defendants we're looking at in Georgia. There's one case in particular I keep going back to. It's actually, I didn't know this until long after, but when we were first searching for new cases back in 2015, someone reached out to me and said they had a friend who was serving life for murder in Georgia, and he pled guilty. And it was a pretty horrific murder, actually. His girlfriend's son was killed, and he apparently, it was a kind of a sort of child like neglect situation, but he says he wasn't there and wasn't involved in it. And when he got to the court hearing, he wasn't going to plead guilty, but the judge told him, if you don't, you're going to get the death penalty. So you better go ahead and accept the plea deal. Now, that doesn't show up in the transcripts. So maybe that didn't happen. Maybe he's remembering wrong. And it was such a stressful time. He's recalling what the judge said to him incorrectly. On the other hand, there are many cases in which Georgia judges have done just this. They've had a transcript that did not reflect what was said in court. And I think it's very possible that judge did tell him, if you don't take this plea deal, you're going to be executed. So he took it. But now we have no way of ever proving that.
Did you find any particular fault with their ruling in the legal sense?
Yeah, it was convoluted. And it was like when I got the ruling and opened it, I read the first line. They were quoting Alexander Hamilton. I'm like, oh, we lost.
Oh, we're boned. Yeah, that's
like if you have to like pretend that you're following the like we have no choice here. As Alexander Hamilton said, we don't have any option to reach a different result. Like, really? You didn't have like your own previous case law, which you have to overrule to get this result. So yeah, I have lots of feelings in that case. And here's the thing, you know, legally it's over, but like there is, like this is a legislative matter and it should be fixed. Now, Georgia is very untransparent when it comes to judicial issues. They're pretty terrible at it in every single way. And so it's not an easy fight, but I think it's a worthwhile one because again, this is a repeated problem in Georgia courts. Like there's the judge who said the N-word in court and had his court reporter not included in the transcript. Like this, again, this will be used more often. This is a ongoing scandal in the judiciary in Georgia, I think, because I suspect that there is a lot of discrepancies out there between transcripts and what was actually said.
So this is going to have to get fixed legislatively. It's going to this is going to have to be taken up with congressmen to, you know, and senators and go up the line of command there, I would imagine.
But again, last year, Georgia voters, due to a convoluted sort of like ballot issue, nixed, basically neutered the Judicial Oversight Board. So judges basically have free rein now to do what they want.
Struggling to find the perfect gift for someone who has it all? Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my code UA in the search bar. That's 75% off. Omaha Steaks offers unique gifts for gourmet food lovers, over 500 gourmet gift ideas, and great steak experiences at home. Now, I can say that for more than 10 years, I've been giving Omaha Steaks packages as gifts to family members for birthdays and holidays, and they always tell me how great the food is and how easy it is to prepare. And Omaha Steaks is more than just steaks. They also offer poultry, pork, lamb, and for people like me, a great selection of seafood, including tuna, trout, and tilapia. And right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just to my listeners. Listen to everything you'll get for less than $50. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steaks seasoning packet, plus you get four additional kielbasa sausages for free. So go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code UA in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
So I wanted to actually get to something that a lot of our listeners were curious about in the episode, and that's the state's star witness, Denise Mitchell. Marissa, it was said at one point that the Innocence Project was in touch with Denise Mitchell, but no longer knows where she is. Have you had any interactions with her that you can talk about?
We haven't had direct interactions with her for a while. Ms. Mitchell is, not surprisingly, in pretty bad straits on a lot of different avenues with her life. But we are aware of where she is and aware of what her situation is.
It's been
a few months since we had contact with her, direct contact.
I had a lot of questions, you know, that she was considered legally blind. You know, we had several listeners asking, you know, could a doctor have testified that she was legally blind at the time? I knew a legally blind person who used to recognize people by their gait, by the way they walked. And that question could have come up at the trial. How much was that delved into at the actual trial?
Well, that's her own definition. She herself described herself that way. And the trial attorney, Jules Epstein, when she was cooperative with him and returning his calls and working, had promised that she would help obtain her vision records. But then she did not follow through with that. And Jules was unable to get in touch with her or compel that information because, you know, it's her own private medical information. So they did try to get that. They tried pretty hard, but they were ultimately unable to get that. Now, as part of our review, I actually called my own optometrist and ophthalmologist and talked to them and said, what does this mean? Like, what would somebody be able to see who had this line of vision? And whether we could try to reproduce that in any way through a digital reconstruction in court. And essentially what the doctors told me was that, you know, it would obviously be limited by the individual in terms of what their own capacity was, but you would lose color after a certain amount of time, and you certainly wouldn't lose any differentiation between shape at a certain particular distance, but they could not make that a universal comment that anyone who has this vision would only have it from here to here. So we were pursuing that from a different angle on the post-conviction side as well.
So it's a lot less clear exactly what she meant by legally blind and exactly whether she was technically diagnosed as such.
That's right. We did not have a medical diagnosis. We only had how she represented it from her own end.
On the other hand, her whole testimony is so sad and sketchy that it feels like quibbling over details that just, like, okay, did she, like, flip a coin? Was it heads or tails? How does that matter? She couldn't have seen what she saw from that angle.
Or where she was. I mean, we're still not sure where she actually was, whether she was on the street, whether she was upstairs, whether she was at the window, whether she was at the bed, so it's hard to kind of put a sustainable narrative through the many different stories that she has kind of told about what happened. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that without the confession, the alleged confession, then Willie would have walked from that based on the, they wouldn't have been able to hold up her identification of him with, the fact that he was working that night and all the evidence that he was actually working that night, which the Commonwealth never really was able to shake. They kind of put a couple different angles on it, but they really never shook it. But so without that, the power of that alleged confession alone is really what, where we are.
I don't think Denise could see what she claimed she saw, even if she had good vision, based on where she was, based on the darkness. I just don't think it's possible to have seen that guy's face from that window, from where it was on the street, because nobody else saw what she saw.
Right.
Nobody else claimed to see his face. And I just can't believe that she saw. And that's what she claimed. She said she recognized him right away.
It sounds very much like she heard the name, put two and two together in her mind, and tried to be helpful, maybe, or something, and went with it.
Maybe. I mean, for Jim and for me, one of the biggest questions on this whole case is, why wasn't the one person who could have really identified the shooter, why wasn't that person called at trial? And he wasn't. He's since deceased. He died after, not related to the shooting, but he died several years afterwards, but he was never called as a witness. There was no real statement ever taken from him beyond what was said in the hospital, as far as we know. And, that's, to us, that's bizarre. Pretty telling. It's very similar to what we saw with Sean Thomas, where you had these eyewitnesses to the actual murder and none of them were called. And that's a huge red flag for us in these cases.
Did the state actually argue that somehow Denise's recollection and recognition of Pee-wee got better after 4 months? Because, obviously she saw the photo array at first and failed to identify him and then saw him again 4 months later. Did the state actually somehow try to bolster that for the jury?
It wasn't a failure to recognize. She said she didn't have time to, didn't want to deal with the police at that time. And that's how they explained it, that it wasn't that she really gave it a good look and didn't identify anybody. She said that she didn't have the time, she didn't want to deal with it, and they came back later, and that's when she made that second identification.
And in an earlier podcast, it was alluded to that she had had some sort of prior relationship with Willie Vesey, or not necessarily a love, a romantic relationship, but that she knew him before that?
Yes. They did all kind of know each other.
Just from the neighborhood, but they didn't have a specific relationship.
Not that we know of.
No, they had seen one another in the bar many times at 8th and Benanga when Willie was playing pool there, and he knew her to say hello to. And that's about it.
And it was also kind of cryptically alluded to in that document that was part of the law students investigating the case that there might have been some payment made to Denise Mitchell. And have you found anything else that in any way corroborates that?
I have not. Have you, Marissa?
Nope.
I have not. That's it.
It's just a floating factoid that may or may mean nothing. Okay.
It's not an uncommon claim, a lot, and one that is almost impossible to verify or corroborate.
As we're well aware from Anand's case.
Yes. Did she ever speak of any interactions with the police that are suspect?
Not that I know of.
But again, and I'm not saying this happened here because as long as I don't know, but one of the recurring patterns in wrongful convictions is sort of vulnerable people who were witnesses or even very often were theoretical witnesses but didn't see anything, who are pressured by the police and just make the police go away, they'll come up with a story.
Right. And that, of course, happens when they're interrogating a suspect as well. I mean, it's the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no difference in the interrogation tactics with a witness vis-a-vis a suspect.
I had a recantation question. We know, obviously, recantations are very problematic, but have there been cases where the courts have taken recantations under consideration and exonerated people based on them?
Based on the recantation alone?
Well, no, not. I would imagine other stuff would have to come into play as well.
But largely based on the recantation? I can't think of any. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but I'm not remembering any.
I'm not aware of any in which there was an actual exoneration based on recantation. I know that the courts in Pennsylvania are starting to look at recantations a little more favorably. There's been a few cases over the last 3 or 4 years where the courts have not just, you know, summarily dismissed them. They've actually looked at them and held that there should be an evidentiary hearing to determine, you know, they're recanting witnesses' credibility, but they're still disfavoring them.
Right.
So in an ideal world, how would a recantation be treated if there was a serious question about whether the convicted person was guilty?
I think that's so fact specific.
But I think the first thing is not just not to dismiss out of hand, right? I mean, mm-hmm. so many times it's witness recants or even comes forward for the first time, the almost automatic response from a court is it's just a recantation. In fact, I've had district attorneys tell me this is just a garden variety recantation, which I find quite offensive because this is, you know, there's no such thing as a garden variety recantation. But it never ceases to amaze me that when, you know, we who have absolutely no power whatsoever, and in fact, by cooperating with us, they are facing a potential perjury charge, witnesses come forward and give us information. But that's disbelief. Whereas at trial, when they have every incentive to lie and cooperate, that's being given kind of this, you know, magic wand passover of truth. And, you know, trying to undo that under those circumstances is extraordinarily frustrating. But what we have found in our work is the best way to deal with a recantation is to try to corroborate the other information in the statement. So, for example, when we had our first clients who were exonerated, Eugene Gilliard and Lance Felder, when we talked to Rolex, the gentleman who actually committed the murder, one of the first things he said was, yeah, I shot another guy that same day with the same gun. So we went to go interview that guy. And he says, yeah, he shot me. And on that day, I went to the hospital. We got his medical records and confirmed that it was the same type of bullet that was used to kill the victim. So it, there are ways to corroborate recantations with other evidence or other looking at things through a different light. And that's really where I think the power of them comes from. But just to put out an affidavit where a witness just says, I lied, that's not helpful. And it really doesn't move the case forward at all.
Well, I have to say, it sounds like Rolex and the person he shot were awfully cooperative. I mean, they, from the way you describe it, they're like, oh, yeah, no, I shot another guy. Oh, and the other guy is like, oh, yeah, he shot me. You know,
yeah. In fact, kind of weird, because in that interview we asked, you know, well, did you report to police? This is no, I stabbed him 7 times 2 weeks later. I'm like, OK, I think we're done.
So it was awkward.
On that angle.
We're good. So. It was a little bizarre.
Yeah, but on the recantations, it's like the prosecutors realize that witness statements don't mean much on their own, that witnesses can and do people in general can and say anything and doesn't mean much at all by itself. But when it comes to statements that help their case, they're everything. And I think that Marissa's right in that you have to, I mean, any statement from anyone by itself doesn't mean much, so it has to be corroborated. That should be applied to the inculpatory ones, too.
Well, it occurred to me that if we, in fact, make it, I don't know, more respectable, I don't know what you would call it, more reliable for a recantation to come in, would that devalue trial testimony? Are they worried that, you know, if you make it easy to recant, then people will have a much more cavalier attitude about honesty at the actual trial?
I think that certainly falls into the equation. And it's also, I mean, I would be disingenuous not to admit that people do lie in their recantations to try to help a buddy or, you know, because they see no negative consequences for themselves. And there are a lot of incredible recantation witnesses out there. But, you know, in the age of exonerations, particularly DNA exonerations and now the non-DNA exonerations, I mean, it's not unfair to say that we're re-looking at lots of different types of evidence that we thought was extraordinarily reliable, like eyewitness identifications or confession or certain types of forensic evidence, and that we now have some real grave concerns about the reliability and accuracy of those types of evidence. It's not a leap at all to say, you know what, witnesses sometimes lie, and there has to be some other evidence of guilt that's a little bit stronger than just a witness who has a potential to be seeking out a benefit for themselves.
Right. I think it's just obvious that, you know, when, you know, one of the key witnesses recants in these cases, that, you know, the court should, you know, sit back and, you know, try to take notice and at least, you know, try to determine whether he or she is telling the truth instead of just blanket throwing them all out and saying, well, these are notoriously unreliable, you know, particularly in line with what we know now about false confessions and false convictions and so many people who've been released. There's got to be, you know, some kind of a way to have these recantations heard and to determine whether they're reliable or not. And as I said, that's happening. You know, the courts are starting to do so, but they still have this tendency to automatically say, no, these things are notoriously unreliable, and we don't want to hear them. That's what happened in the Sean Thomas case. William Stallworth was, you know, it was just thrown out because, you know, the judge decided it was notoriously unreliable until he finally told the DA's office, and, you know, they sat back and listened.
And that case, of course, is to me the height of irony, because what the witnesses said at trial was, you know, facially unreliable and inaccurate. And yeah, as you guys covered extraordinarily well in the podcast, what they said at trial was physically impossible. They could not have, it could not have happened the way they explained. And yet that was taken at absolute face value without even the most basic attempt to try to determine reliability and accuracy.
Mm-hmm. And I will say sometimes it is hard. I mean, I'm a defense attorney, so I know I'm biased. But it is sometimes hard to imagine what the prosecutors are thinking. As an attorney, even, just, I struggle with that. And it's hard to, I mean, most prosecutors aren't doing this, but a lot of them know they can get away with it. And when you don't have any sort of pressure or pushback against these behaviors, of course they're going to happen. But even the ones who mean well and generally aren't trying to sort of cheat the system will often somehow believe in their own heads these convoluted scenarios. Again, that's me as a defense attorney being biased, but it's troubling.
And I want to welcome to the podcast Colin Miller. I'm not going to do his bio because everybody knows who Colin is, for God's sakes. But welcome, Colin.
Thanks, John.
You actually came here at a good time. We were talking about prosecutors' use and or abuse of what they consider credible testimony and in terms of recantations. And actually, you brought up the term falsus in uno in the podcast, which struck me as a particularly dumb saying, only because human beings are occasionally dishonest. You know, I don't know that there's a human being on earth who has been honest in every single interaction that they've had as a human. But by that saying, you could dismiss anything that was said. You know, recently we had on the podcast Amber Hunt, who's accused podcast, talks of a story. There's an important witness in that case who saw the likely killer but lied to some extent because he didn't say that his son was with him at the time. You know, there's no reason to find his account not credible, but he lied. And I imagine these types of things happen all the time.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, really the falsus in uno would apply more to the defense claiming that about prosecution witnesses, because the prosecution has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in this case, the prosecutor's kind of trying to claim the alibi witnesses are basically not credible on one aspect of their testimony, and that invalidates their whole testimony. And I think that's wrong. I mean, I think it's wrong on either side. I think that, as you say, people make mistakes. Sometimes people do tell smaller lies. I don't think that invalidates everything they have to say. I think it means you have to understand the full picture of the testimony and decide, do these errors and possible lies undermine everything else that witness had to say?
And in that particular case, the prosecutor's point was kind of dumb. I'm sorry for just talking about how dumb things are, because he was acting as though the co-workers of Willie Vesey were gathering around him and creating a false alibi for him, which didn't make any sense in the context of how it was presented.
Yeah, and that's something that I think definitely Susan addressed and probably knows best in the podcast, just saying the restaurant's not going to be liable for this murder in any way. And to claim that these managers at Houlihan's are circling the wagons and trying to protect their corporation from liability, and that's why they're lying on behalf of Willie, it just really doesn't hold water.
I wanted to get to reluctant witnesses, because in this particular case, we're dealing with the revelation that there were several co-workers of Willie's at the Houlihan's who felt like they knew who had actually committed the murder but were afraid to talk. But it's not clear to me, were they afraid to talk because they felt that there would be retribution from the actual murderer or from the police? I don't know if, does anybody have any insight into what that was?
I mean, it's kind of two things. Like, there's a common recurring issue that they just don't want to get involved, period. Because again, you start talking, maybe you'll end up like Denise Mitchell. And then also, in some cases, if they have very specific knowledge of what really happened, they might actually fear someone else in the streets.
Considering that you guys, Marissa and Jim, are with the Innocence Project, do you run into reluctant witnesses a lot? Because I imagine you're dealing with a lot of times people in sort of a criminal underworld who are reluctant to come forward to begin with. Do you have any methods for gaining their trust?
I'll let Jim take that one.
Oh, okay. Well, gaining their trust is basically, you know, sometimes trying to appeal to their consciences, which you know, we did with the Stallworths in the Sean Thomas case. And it may have been done with Denise in the earlier 2000s investigation in which she recanted. I'm not sure what they did with that. But that's one way to go and try to talk to a witness. Look, this guy's in prison. You know he's innocent. You can't leave him there. In fact, I think Willie touched on that in his discussion with you when he said that he can't believe that people have knowledge of this crime and have not come forward knowing there's an innocent man in prison. So that's one way to do it. But yes, there are often, as Willie also pointed out, there's a whole culture on the streets of, no snitching or stop snitching. And if people are afraid to talk or just don't want to talk because they'll be labeled a rat. And sometimes that's hard to overcome. I would think even an appeal to conscience sometimes doesn't work in that respect.
One thing I've had some good luck with is that telling witnesses who are very reluctant to talk about something that happened in the case that was either misused their statement or the prosecutor like contradicted what they'd said. And they'll start off not wanting to talk to me. I'm like, well, then I just want you to clarify, why the prosecutor say that you said X, Y, Z? And when they hear that often I found just gets them talking. They're like, wait, what? They said what about me? And when they find out that their statement's been misused by the prosecutor, it opens the door, I think.
And from our perspective, talking with witnesses who may be reluctant, it is about building trust and building relationships, because a lot of these witnesses feel that they've been very badly mistreated by the criminal justice system. You know, they kind of had information and either got taken literally or got twisted, and they weren't really part of that. And they had no power in any of that. So when we're talking to witnesses, a lot of it is just about listening to them, their experiences through a particular case or the justice system itself, and trying to kind of work with them where they're at. But they need to understand with us that, you know, this is not just a one and done thing, that in order to, you know, have this case go to fruition, then, you know, this is kind of a long-term involvement, if you will. But like with one of the Stallworth brothers that I had dealings with, you know, I met him 3 or 4 times and we kind of kept in touch while he was in prison, because he realized that it wasn't just about tell me what happened, then okay, I can go wash my hands, I'm done. So you have to build that trust and that relationship with them from the very beginning. And of course, it's most important is that they understand it's just about telling the truth, that we don't want them to shade things. I don't want them to tell me something that didn't happen. I want them to tell me exactly what happened and what their memory is. And that, you know, trying to explain to them that, look, you know, whatever you tell me is what you tell me. That's the fact. That's all I want to know. That also kind of helps to breed that a little bit, I think.
You also get a lot. You talk to someone like, I'm going to tell you right now, you don't want to talk to me. What I'm going to tell you is not going to help you. And you have to convince them, like, I don't care. Just tell me it.
Right. Because we want to know the truth.
And also what they know, they often don't know how it applies to the case anyway. So they think and they believe the person's guilty because they believe a certain set of facts. So they're not sure why you want to talk to them. They don't realize that what they know applies in a different way.
That's true. I mean, and the same applies with suspects who talk to police, right? I mean, they'll talk to police knowing that they're innocent and say something innocuous, which turns into something very meaningful and inculpatory, either admitting they were there, they saw it, or they were in the area, that becomes twisted around on the same side. I mean, it goes both ways, both with witnesses and with suspects.
One thing that I found interesting was there was a surprising number of people who you couldn't find, like the professor, was that William Tyson, I believe, at the University of Pennsylvania. It's rare for professors to just disappear into the ether. You know, Colin, I don't know if you have any particular expertise in that area, but have you guys had any further investigation on that?
For Professor Tyson?
Yes.
And specifically? No, we didn't, because frankly, it's not anything that's relevant at this point for Willie. What helps Willie now and what matters to him is proving his innocence based on facts or, you know, through a reinvestigation by the conviction review unit. So whatever Professor Tyson did or didn't do really is not
something that's critically important to our assessment or where we're at right now. We'd love to talk to him, sure, but you know, it's not something that we're going to really break down walls to try to find him.
Just because it was, you know, there was that WTF memo, as you mentioned. My thinking was, you know, it could lead to a new trail that might be fortuitous for you. I don't know. I was just throwing that out there. Oh, now one thing that struck me about the podcast was that at one point it became clear that you couldn't question Willie Vesey about his arrest and interrogation because of his emotional state. But that must have been very tough for you guys, because it seems like his account of the interrogation might be very valuable to you guys. So how do you make that judgment of how much you can question?
But I mean, first and foremost, we're dealing with a human being, right? I mean, Willie is somebody that I've known now for about 9 years. You know, I care for him. I care about him. I think that he's a good man. So you don't want to cause him any pain or trauma, particularly because I'm not there to help him deal with the after effect. So when we interviewed him with Jim Tranum and he had an emotional reaction, you know, I was very surprised by that, but also very concerned, because I'm not there for him when he has to go back into the solitariness of his cell and kind of deal with all that trauma. But you're right. At the same time, we need information. So that informed us in terms of how we can approach this with him in the future and how far we think we can go, and whether we can just rely on the earlier interview for the crux of the information that we have. So I was very surprised by his reaction, quite frankly, because Willie, I mean, you know, by the ironic Pee-wee, he's a big guy, you know, and it never made sense to me why he would confess to something that he did not do, because I didn't think he would be physically intimidated, you know, by officers who were smaller than him, frankly. But I got a window into how he handles things and reacts things through that interview, and it all of a sudden made a lot more sense to me from that. So it's a very difficult decision to have to make, because obviously we need information, but you can't be cold and calculating about that and forget that there's a human being on the other side of that interview.
And you've had a lot of interactions with Willie's family. What has your experience been like dealing with them?
They're amazing. I mean, his sister in particular, she'll call, you know, when she's sitting in dialysis, just to kind of check in and see what's going on. But with them too, there's a strong emotional component here. I don't think I've had a conversation with his sister where she doesn't get upset about the fact that her brother has been taken away from her and that she cannot have that relationship with him that she wants. And it's the same with his mother and his stepfather. His stepfather has wanted to move, you know, for years because he thinks it'd be easier to get a smaller house. They don't have to take care of it. And his mother just refuses because she knows Willie's coming home and she wants to have the home ready for him when he does. And that's extraordinarily powerful, that her faith and her belief, but also just that she is putting everything else on hold because her baby is still taken from her.
It amazes me when people who've experienced this have any faith in the system at this point, because by all indications, Willie Vesey had no criminal record, had no interactions with the police that we know of. It must have been just incredibly shocking to the family for this to occur.
Right. It's like being thrown in the
pool. They're all in trauma. Yeah.
When you don't know how to swim. And that's, you know, it really is that shocking, and that you have to just breathe and try to get through it.
Actually, last week, on a hopeful note, there was a very bit of a blockbuster election in Philadelphia. They elected Larry Krasner, who was a guest on this podcast. So basically, we are the kingmakers.
let's just face call it. Us Comey.
but obviously, the guy has a huge challenge ahead of him. Already, there are police groups that are coming out and having issues with him. Are you guys in a hopeful situation because of this?
Of course. I mean, I think based on some of the things that Mr. Krasner said during the campaign, one of the key points was that he wants to make sure that cases of, you know, innocence are fairly reviewed and are fairly dealt with. So assuming that he keeps that, I see no reason why he wouldn't. You know, I would think that many of our clients are in a much better position than they might have been before. And I think that his take on a lot of these issues is going to be very different from any other district attorney we've had. I think that's putting quite mildly. But I also think that people are going to be very surprised. I mean, the police reaction and other people's reaction that, oh, he's just a radical, he's going to do crazy stuff, just really doesn't understand the man. Larry is extraordinarily
intelligent. He's a Stanford law grad. He's been listening to people. He's been going around talking to law enforcement, talking to district attorneys, finding out what the best practices are. So it's not just about implementing some ideology of his own, but he understands the role and he understands what his job is going to be. And I think people will be surprised at some of the things that he does when he takes office and the direction that he takes the office and takes the trainings in particular.
On the other hand, he is just one man and it's an uphill battle. Just the reaction of the Philly police officers online with their, like, what, hashtag not my DA?
Right. I mean, I think that that's a small number, frankly. I know many sworn officers who voted for him and who are perfectly happy to support him as the DA. And I think he'll have the very strong backing of the commissioner, of course, of Commissioner Ross. And, you know, I think that, you know, we'll get that all that kind of out now. And to the extent that it happens after he takes office, there are ways to deal with that, which I don't think the department or the DA's office will have any trouble doing.
Yeah, especially when it's on your Facebook with your name.
I wanted to get around to the Whacker Squad and how they work and the likely trail of litigation that appears to be following them. I mean, obviously, with Larry Krasner in office, that changes the complexion of it somewhat. But have these gentlemen retired?
Jim knows them a little bit more about it than I, but I think that one of them retired, then he went back, and then he retired again. So they're kind of back and forth a bit.
They basically retired from the Philly Police Department back in the 1990s. Several of them went to the New Jersey side of the river and worked for the Camden County Prosecutor. You retired from there, were called out of retirement, and I believe has since retired again.
Now, did you, Jim, know of the Whacker Squad? I mean, had their legend reached your ears at that point?
We knew who they were. I mean, I knew who they were, and I knew that there was a squad in homicide that was trained in entry techniques along with SWAT, which at the time was known as the Stakeout Unit, and that they were using special weapons and things like that. But I didn't know their names exactly. I do know who they are now, and I had heard of them before, but I didn't know who the people in that squad were at the time.
Did you hear about their extraordinary clearance rate at that time?
Not at that time, no. That came up like a few years later when I was in the intelligence unit and I was hearing stories and in the DEA task force.
But was the tone generally of admiration or, you know, in terms of hearing the stories, or were there, by the way, I'm not asking you to talk out of school and I'm just curious how they were perceived in the department.
Well, I can only speak for myself in that it was basically incredulity that somebody was clearing 90 to 95% of his investigations in homicide, where, as we said earlier, you've got a no snitch culture. You've got, people who don't even claim that they were shot when they lived. They don't even know anything. They just heard a shot and they wound up, falling down and that's it. So it's hard to solve murders under those circumstances. And today, I believe there's been a series of stories in the Philadelphia papers over the last year or two that it maintains that the current clearance rate is about 37%. So if you're clearing 90 to 95% of your homicide investigations, you're doing pretty good work. I'm not sure.
Well, hopefully.
Well, I mean, when I say good work, I'm saying it tongue in cheek, because I can't imagine how you could have a rate that high.
Yeah. My point being that I didn't know if they were if people at the time were credulous about it. But as you said, those particular statistics didn't come out till later.
Correct. And I don't think people were really interested at the time in thinking about, hey, is it possible to have that high of a clearance rate? I mean, I personally did when I heard that. I think people were just, cops who I knew were more interested in just thinking about, hey, that's really something. Let's move on and do our job. I mean, I don't think anybody really paid attention to what the clearance rate was at the time or who was doing what. I mean, this all came out later. At the time, we weren't really, hearing stories about it.
And were police at the time, you mentioned that I think you were in the narcotics unit at the time?
Yes.
Yeah. Did the idea that false confessions were being pulled from people, had that idea reached the department, or were people still operating under the assumption that these were true?
I think they were operating under that assumption that they were true. I mean, we never even dreamed at the time that these cases were going along, which is late 80s, early 90s, that there was such a thing as false confessions. I think we all maintained the illusion then, as many people do now, that no one would falsely confess. They could never make me confess. And yet we know for a fact that that's not true. And as I became more familiar with that whole phenomenon of false confessions, I began to question some of these cases myself.
I wonder, have they ever done any studies on death-qualified jurors and their beliefs on false confessions?
Not that I'm aware of.
Because I suspect there might be a correlation there.
Well, I think there's probably a correlation with disqualified juries and a lot of more conservative viewpoints in the criminal justice system.
I don't know how you would statistically get that, though. I mean, would you wait till everybody came off of death qualified juries and then ask them a survey? You know, honestly, I think that would be an incredibly valuable service if somebody partook that. But it sounds very labor intensive.
Yeah.
You could try to just get a pool of people and ask them the same questions you ask during the death qualification process and then follow up on that and essentially have maybe a simulation. The problem with all these types of jury simulation projects are it's not real life and you don't know if you're getting the real thing. But I think that's something that could be run, and I would be interested to see what the results would be of that study.
Actually, Colin mentioned there was an article recently in the Philadelphia papers about a prosecutor apologizing to the 55-year-old man who he prosecuted as a 15-year-old 40 years before that, who he now thinks is innocent. Have any of you guys seen that? It's Gerald Dugan was the prosecutor.
Right. And the defendant who was convicted, his name is Kevin Brinkley. The family's always maintained that it was actually his brother who had committed the murder and not Kevin, and that it was a mistaken identification essentially the whole time.
You know, you should know that, you know, brother actually did confess to the murder
right
in court. And, you know, the judge didn't believe the confession. So once again, it's like the recantation where it's notoriously unreliable. So years ago, this guy came to court and said, no, I did it, not my brother. And they say this has no credibility and kept the brother in prison for years.
Did he do that during an appeal?
During a post-conviction.
And they both took polygraph tests and they passed. Now, of course, we know lie detector evidence isn't that reliable. But still, we had both brothers taking the test and one saying, I was the one who killed this egg delivery man. And the other one saying, it wasn't me. And they both passed. And the brother obviously came in and said, I did it. But yeah, I mean, 40 years, age 15 to age 55, he was incarcerated.
But the DA's office is still maintaining that that they got the right man, even though this former prosecutor is now believes otherwise.
That's correct.
Yeah, and this is a case where he was a juvenile. He was 15 years old, and he was given a mandatory life without parole sentence. And so what happened here was there was a Supreme Court opinion, and we'll get into this opinion actually in our next series, that the Terrence Lewis case is they're having these resentencing hearings in Pennsylvania and across the country. And so that's what resulted in him being released.
Right.
He was not exonerated. He was just released because he had an illegal sentence. That's correct.
I have some listener questions, if you guys are up for them. This is from Jenny, who said, didn't a report exist, confirmation of her disability of sight from Denise Mitchell's eye doctor, which could have been used at trial to prove that her second testimony was right? And if so, why did the judge not rely on that report?
Right. Well, like I said, the trial attorneys tried to get those records, but they were unable to do so. And we can't recreate that now. Frankly, she doesn't even remember the name of her doctor that she was seeing at the time.
And it's not like Denise, you know, said that she could see perfectly well. She admitted it at trial that she had a seat, you know, I'm not sure what her exact words were, but she said she had some kind of a slight disability and had problems and needed glasses. So, I mean, you know, she admitted that she had problems seeing.
This one is from Dr. Marks. It says, could you guys explain how the conviction review unit operates and how it justifies its decisions?
Well, I think you'd really have to talk to them about the second part of that. In terms of how they operate, our experience has been that there's a form that the inmate or their lawyer sign, which is kind of a cooperation agreement, and that they provide access to the prosecutor's file as well as the police file, assuming they can find them. We're having a little trouble with that with Willie's case. And then they, in my experience with them so far, I think they've been very resolute about talking to people in a very objective way and not kind of going in with a presumed outcome for it. And they'll talk to pretty much any witness that they can talk to, as well as review files and kind of try to come to an independent decision. I think that they view their job as being truly outside the normal legal process. And so they're kind of looking at it almost as a cold case. And did we get the right result?
Yeah, and I've sort of been going up the chain of command there at the conviction review unit. And I just heard back. I finally have someone who I think they're saying is going to go on the record and not discuss the specific details of any of these cases, but essentially say, here's how our process works. And so I think it'll probably mostly match up with what Marissa's saying, but I would like to definitely hear from them themselves and see what they have to say about their process.
Right.
So, Marissa and Jim, it was the conviction review unit that overturned Sean Thomas's conviction, correct?
Well, technically the court did, but they agreed to it, right?
Got it. And can I ask you, this is, were either one of you the people who actually got to inform Sean that he was going to be released?
I was, yes, that's correct.
Okay, can you describe that moment a little bit?
Well, I was on the phone with Sean, and he had been making phone calls to me from the prison on like a daily basis for updates. And I had the letter from the DA's office in which they agreed to to vacate Sean's conviction. And I started to read them the letter. I said, Sean, we got a letter today from the DA's office. You might want to hear this. And I read it for him. He didn't say anything at first, and he didn't seem to understand what I was telling him. And I said, do you understand what I just read to you? And he said, not really. And I said, okay, let me read it to you again. And it's only a one paragraph letter. And I read it to him and I said, you know what that means? And he said, I think so, but it's a little shocking. And I said, Sean, you're going home. And he said, I'm going home. And I said, yeah, they've agreed to let you go. They're going to vacate your conviction. And I said, so probably in the next 2 weeks, you're going to be leaving prison. And after being there for 24 years, I know it was a pretty emotional thing for Sean. And, He actually took it by laughing. He broke out in hysterical laughter because he said, are you joking with me? And I said, no, I'm not joking. This is a letter we got from the DA's office today. I'm going to be coming up there and taking you out of prison. And he was just sort of overwhelmed and didn't say anything for a while. And then he said, okay, I've got to let my family know if this is true. And I said, yes. And that's when he set it up with his mother and his sister. So it was a great time.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, those are the great times you're always looking forward to. Here is another one from Daniel RYYC. Okay, here we go. I've always been curious how the undisclosed team considers the other side of the investigation. Say an innocent person like Adnan is released. Is that the end of the case for undisclosed, or is there a plan to get justice for the victim of the crime? Not sure if this has been answered, but I just finished the episode 3 of the Sean Thomas.
That's not, at that point, that's not our job. And I think we can only do more harm than good to still be involved.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's something you have to leave to the state at that point. And I think it's beyond our expertise, our resources. And yeah, just probably a bad idea overall for us to try to actually track down who committed the crime.
And this from Amanda Feliciano. You know what really gets me about the court rejecting recantations is that cops are always saying about cold cases, oh, people now might have something different to say. Maybe an old girlfriend will be pissed at this subject now and talk. So they're saying something different from what they said in the past, and law enforcement and the prosecution would use that to convict someone. How is that different from a recantation? So disgusting. I love y'all, but you make me hate our justice system. LOL. that sort of encapsulates everything. I love y'all, but you make me hate our justice system. LOL. it's all mixed up in there. I think you actually brought up that point earlier. I think Susan Colin, there seems to be a very convenient set of confirmation bias that they absolutely believe something like this when it's in their interest and absolutely disbelieve it when it overturns a lot of work they've done.
And that's part of the adversarial system. I mean, that's how it goes. It's two opposing sides arguing their case, and that's fine for what it is. But the power imbalance is so stark here. It's a one-way racket for this evidence. Like, it only is good when it makes someone guilty, and it's what's the phrase you use? A garden variety case of recantation when it goes the other way.
It sort of looks at DNA in the same manner, John. I mean, I've seen cops and prosecutors say that DNA, when it's used to prosecute someone and convict that person, is just the be all and end all. But when it's used to exonerate someone, it has to be taken in context along with the rest of the evidence. And that's just simply not true. It's a sword and a shield. If it's absolutely used to convict somebody, it can absolutely be used to exonerate someone. So I see that as the same, sort of bias that we see in the recantation testimony as well.
Well, that's all I've got in listener questions. I want to thank you, Jim, for being here. Much, much appreciated. You're always welcome to come back. I imagine we'll be talking to you even more as we talk about more of the Philadelphia cases.
And once we have more. The sealing order is lifted.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So now we're all just waiting for bombshells, Colin.
Now I know what it feels like.
Exactly. It blows. It totally blows. But we will remain on bombshell watch, and we will let our listeners know the moment we hear them. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. All right, have a good day, everybody.
Okay, thanks, Jim. And that is all for the addendum this week. But before we go, I want to remind everyone that there were several important figures in this case that the undisclosed team would still love to hear from. So if you have any contact or any information with some of the co-workers of Willie VC at the Houlihans, James Miller, whose nickname was The Lover, Mark Griffin, whose nickname was Gump, and Richard Lee, if you have any information or any way to contact them, please email us at undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. That would be very, very helpful. Remember, all of the case documents and photos are posted at undisclosed-podcast.com, as well as a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to. And as I said, I will be donating all of my fees to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, for his research once again, as well as Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for their help on production. Patrick Cortez composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan is our project manager. Thank you once again, Methil. And thank you all for listening. I'll be missing a few episodes of Addendum in the next few weeks, but I will be back. I shall return, I swear. So thank you once again. Bye-bye.